Behind every life transformed by medicine is a story, one that often begins with an investigator with a fresh idea, an idea that turns into a study and that ultimately advances patient care. Only innovation can truly help our patients live longer, healthier lives. Hello, my name is Dr. Kristen Siomber, and I'm an associate professor of medicine at the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center. This is the monthly podcast of ACRU, the Cancer Research Network, whose mission is to establish the next level study for cancer research across the major disease groups. In this podcast, we want to hear the stories behind the innovative ideas and listen to the unique journeys of our researchers. Listen in as we explore the people and ideas of today's leading translational research. Welcome to the ACRU Transformative Research Podcast. My name is Dr. Kristen Siomber, and I'm excited to host this episode as we explore the stories and innovation of today's leading translational research. Our special guest today, again, is Dr. Fengxu Oh. I interviewed Dr. Oh recently, and I wanted to follow up on some additional questions. As I mentioned in the previous conversation, Dr. Oh is an associate professor of biostatistics at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She also is a faculty statistician for the Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology, leading several gastrointestinal phase 3 clinical trials that aim to improve patient care. Dr. Oh is also the group statistician for ACRU, the sponsor of this podcast, the Cancer Research Network. Her research interest is in survival analysis with the goal of developing new statistical methods for clinical trial design and analysis and assimilating these new methods into practice. I'm professionally connected with Dr. Oh because of her work on REDOS, as well as multiple other trials through ACRU. By leading phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trials, Dr. Oh is involved in assessing the efficacy of new agents and aims to provide better treatment options for patients. Dr. Oh is also working to develop new statistical methods to tackle challenges in clinical trial design specific to immunotherapy and precision medicine. Dr. Oh, thank you for joining us again today. We're glad to have you back.
Thank you for having me again. This is my pleasure to be here.
So Dr. Oh, after our last conversation, I wanted to drill down into some more specific questions about your work as a biostatistician. I thought a deeper dive might be helpful to the investigators who actually listen to our podcasts.
Absolutely. I would love to share my experience and perspective.
As an investigator myself, I would really like hearing about the statistical mistakes that can happen in designing and analyzing studies. I think that that happens pretty often with us, especially if we don't have a statistician involved from the beginning on different projects. So what are some of the common mistakes that you see, and what should an investigator know about biostatistics as he or she starts a study?
I wouldn't say they're mistakes. I would say maybe points for improvement.
That's very kind.
The first one I would say, when consulting with a statistician, right? Sometimes a physician walking my door and said, I want you to run this model for me, and I want you to do this test for me. And my answer to them is, before you tell me what statistical analysis you want, please share with me your research question, because that's a good collaboration. Yes, like the physician, you have your perspective of your medical interest, the question that you have, and the scientific understanding. And what statisticians bring to the table is the logic, the way of dissecting your research question to an approachable data analysis question. So rather than telling me what to do, I really appreciate when the physician comes into my door and say, here is an interesting question, let's talk about this. So I definitely really appreciate that. And I think that foster good collaboration relationship as well. Other stuff that's common in a lot of research questions that I have seen is, I'll just mention three of them. I think those are the three that I most prevalent as far as, in my opinion. One is spurious correlation. So when we have a huge data set, if you keep looking at it, you can always find something. But that something is just the correlation. It doesn't tell you the underlying relationship between the cause of the relationship. But a lot of physicians will say, well, I found this, so that must be the truth. For example, if we do a study in emergency medicine and we find elevated level of a lab test, will always cause a death, we may say, oh, that lab test is will cause you to die. But really, the lab test caused the patient to come to the emergency room, and they're not doing well, and therefore they die. And if you look at that same lab test in a general population, then we might find nothing at all. So that's one danger that I see in medical research. And the other one is, we call it p-value hacking sometimes. It's similar to, like, if you look at stuff long enough, you'll find something, right? Let's say we start out with like 10 different tests. I will say, oh, we found nothing. And the physician said, but I really need this paper published with something significant. So let's look for another 10 different thing, and next 10 different thing. And I sometimes say we went on a fishing expedition. When you don't have a good guidance for what your research question is guiding you to do, then we're really just looking for that noise existing in the data set. And we thought it can be the true relationship. The last one is really the misinterpretation of the data. And that sometimes I understand, like, not all physicians are trained in statistics. So I don't think it's intentional, like, over interpreting the data. But what happened is there is a difference between you find nothing versus they are the same. Like, for example, a lot of time we do a comparison of two groups, and then we say there's no difference between the groups. Sometimes the physician will write the two groups are equivalent, but that's very different. So when you find no difference between two things, it doesn't really tell me they are equivalent. So the unintentional misinterpretation of the data is another issue here.
These are great points. I'm actually taking notes here because I want to remember these. Going back to your first comment, just in terms of sitting down with the investigator from the very beginning of the project, that's something I learned from you from the beginning, I think, when we first started working together, because what I really appreciate about you, Pangshu, is that you are really interested in the science. So it's not only about the statistics and how to get the answer and the analyses, but you try to understand the reasons why behind why we actually do some of these and look at some of these questions. And I think that's really key to have us working together as a team, as opposed to, you know, some investigators may see a statistician as, you know, just a number cruncher. And I think you really elevate our science in many ways by doing that and by being involved in the beginning. And what I've recognized over the years is when I don't involve a statistician early, it just makes my life harder. So it's in everybody's best interest to do that from the beginning. But I really loved your points of the areas we can improve in. So understanding correlation, not causation, the p-value hacking, which I know many of us are guilty of, and doing fishing expeditions, and then the misinterpretation of data. So thank you for bringing those up. I wanted to kind of ask you also, going back to starting a project from scratch, what are the questions that you need answered before a study begins? So in addition to understanding kind of the reason behind why we're doing a study, what are some specific questions that you need answered so that you know how best to design the study, you know, with the investigator? And in your opinion, how much of the science behind the study do you need to know to really do a good job?
For a statistician, like I mentioned, I appreciate you said, what is your research question, right? The most important thing is really truly understand the research question. So then we can think about the best design to answer this research question, best data to collect, the appropriate statistical analysis, and all those stem from what is your research question. So understand that question first is important. And I maybe you are thinking, oh, my question is very clear. But I have a physician coming to my office and said, I want to know A is better than B. I was like, great. How do you define better? And then immediately there's a long pause and say, huh. I was like, do you mean this lab test is higher value is best, better, or the mice live longer is better? Like, which one, what do you mean by better, right? So such a simple question, sometimes leading to a 10-minute discussion. So really knowing the research question, for me, is the most important.
Okay.
And if we're focusing on a clinical trial design, right, definitely I'll ask for the information I need in order to perform a sample size calculation. For example, what is the current standard of care in this disease setting, and what is the performance of the standard of care? So we have a benchmark. That's the target that we want to be better than. Also, I want to know whether it's a phase one study, phase two, or phase three, because that give me, that put my mindset in a different place. Am I going to look for toxicity, or I'm looking for early anti-tumor activity, or I'm going to design a confirmatory large scale study? And that give me different information that in the back of my mind, I start thinking about what is the best study design. Like you mentioned earlier, I personally am very interested in the science behind what we do. I believe that make me a better statistician, I hope.
Absolutely, yes.
Because I think if we just do, like you say, the number cruncher, or sometimes I joke about, we call it the p-value monkey. If we just need a p-value monkey, you really don't need me. Because what I bring to the table is more than just give you a number. What I bring to the table is more than just statistics. In clinical trial design, physicians tend to have a big picture of what's the medical question or the scientific question they want to answer. And part of my job is really asking a lot of questions. So I can help the physician to think through all this question, because those questions may be the break or make or break of a trial.
Last thing you want to do is do this whole study and then find out that the results weren't helpful because you didn't think about, you know, the pitfalls going in.
Or sometimes like logistic of a clinical trial is so diverse. And we, being the statistician that's seen so many trial, sometimes can have a prior experience, can utilize that prior experience to your study and say, okay, here's what I experienced last time. Is the same issue going to happen in this study? Can we prevent it before we make the same mistake again? And all those things help me to be a better statistician.
I see your value in that as well, in just having a broader experience and perspective, because many of us as investigators tend to be very narrow focused, either in our area of clinical expertise or our research questions, and sometimes, you know, we can all certainly benefit from your experience and others' experience, so that we can make sure that we don't repeat the mistakes that other people have made. So those are great. Thank you. One other thing that I see investigators do, and probably myself included, is to get ahead of the endpoint analysis. So what are the risks in doing that? And I also think that sometimes we want the answer fast. And so we try to, you know, even unintentionally cut corners or try to look at the data early. And I know that's a no-no. Yes. But tell me a little bit more about that and the pitfalls there.
So there is a lot of publication out there already, like explaining why maintaining confidentiality of interim data can enhance trial integrity and credibility. And what happened is, when we have early data, we only have partial information, right? We only know what happened to the first half of the patient or first 10. And a lot of time that doesn't tell us the full picture. So actually there is a publication, they found out that more than one third of the clinical trials publishing interim finding failed to report the final result.
Wow. Wow.
Because when you, and I'll give you an example on that. And then also 1/5 of the trial changed their conclusion in final publication. So that discordant between the interim finding and final analysis is truly the reason why we don't want to release the interim data. Because another unintended consequences of releasing the interim data is that may change physicians' behavior. For example, there is a study called Allogliptin after acute coronary syndrome in patients with type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. So that study was designed to assess the potential elevated cardiovascular risk from a common drug in patients with type 2 diabetes. And during the interim analysis, there is some signal suggesting maybe the drug is truly harmful for patient, but they didn't release the interim data. Because you can imagine if they release the interim data, most physicians will probably be very hesitant to put additional patients onto the trial. So the trial may never finish enrollment. So the interim data was never released, study met full accrual, and with sufficient amount of data information, the final conclusion of a trial is actually this drug is not harmful for the patient. And this conclusion will never be able to be delivered if we release an interim analysis and suddenly the patient enrollment will just cease to exist.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I think as investigators and just as physicians, we were very swayed by data. So, but we don't always think about, you know, whether the data is accurate or we have the full analysis. So, you know, we hear a conclusion and unfortunately sometimes base our practice around it without really delving into the data. So that's a great point. It's interesting though, because, you know, obviously we have stopping rules and futility analyses too. So I think we need to make a distinction there in terms of, you know, you also don't want to harm patients by suppressing data. And obviously that's not what you were talking about, but I think designing the studies appropriately so that you maximize that balance in terms of making sure patients aren't being harmed by giving them a futile intervention, but also making sure that you get the data so that ultimately you can move the field forward, hopefully, with the results.
Yes, I think it's important to distinguish like pre-planned interim data release pre-planned safety look versus the I just want to know kind of attitude. Because if it's pre-planned, if it's pre-planned, I really don't have an issue with it, because your decision or your action after you learn that piece of information is predetermined.
Yes.
And it's not being influenced by your belief or your understanding at that specific time. The danger of releasing interim data is, for example, the diabetes example, you might stop enrolling patient, or I also heard a horror story, like they look at the interim, the physician look at the interim data and say, oh, look at this subgroup of patient. I think this agent worked particularly well in this subgroup. So they change the enrollment criteria to that specific subgroup only. But then it turns out that subgroup is not special. It doesn't really enrich your population. And that decision of changing the enrollment based on interim data really messed up the study.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Oh, it's just, there's so many pitfalls in studies. So we're glad we have you and your colleagues to help us think through these things as we're going through, not only in the design, but also that it just reiterates to me that, you know, we need you all through the whole study from start to finish, because there's a lot, you know, we tend to think that a study is just, once it starts, it's just going to, you know, continue without any changes. But there are sometimes really valid reasons to, you know, update eligibility, or as the science improves and we discover, say, primary tumor sidedness matters in colorectal cancer, you know, sometimes there are real valid reasons to change that. But if we don't do that in a thoughtful way, then we can really invalidate the study. What are some recent trends in biostatistics? I'm particularly interested in what you think about big data. We also know that, you know, as we think specifically in cancer, the catchphrase now is, you know, every cancer is a rare cancer, either molecularly, you know, subtype wise, or we just learn more about each individual cancer so that we don't just think lung cancer now. We think, you know, all of the different subtypes, breast cancer and colon cancer. So how is that affecting statistics? And what do you see in terms of both the upcoming advantages to looking at these rare data sets, but also what are some of the disadvantages or the things we need to think about to make sure we're analyzing the data correctly?
So the buzzword right now in the statistical world, I guess, or non-statistical world is like machine learning, data science, artificial intelligence, and that's the newest and hottest buzzword, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think they are definitely a very useful tool. Like Netflix know what kind of movie I like, right? Yeah. Like grocery store will send me the coupon of food items I often purchase. Google can really find those useful information when you're typing a search word. And all those are possible because of the advance in machine learning, the data science. So they're definitely a place for it. And it does make our life better. However, the flip side of it is somebody will truly believe that we don't need research anymore. We can find all the answers by data science, by big data, by mining, by using the observed data sets. And I think it's dangerous because the data set itself can be very biased to begin with.
Mm.
For example, if there's research done on like racial differences in case reporting to public data sets. And imagine that if the reporting are not the same between different subgroup of patients, peoples, then what we find can be very different.
Mm-hmm.
So if we blindly believe that what we discover from a data set is the truth, that can be very misleading. And again, like I mentioned at the beginning, in a large data set, I can find so many different things, but they may just be some noise exists in the data set or the correlation that means nothing. Well, I have a good example for you. So I was peripherally involved in a project. There's a company who took our clinical data set and trying to do some sort of data mining to discover, hopefully, new prognostic variable for colorectal cancer. In one of the presentation, the company statistician say, oh, we discovered this one new thing that so perfectly predict patient's outcome. And I was like, ooh, I would love to know what it is. And maybe a little background will be helpful. This is the trial data is like stage 4 colorectal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Company statistician said, oh, we discover the longer a patient can stay on treatment, the better they do.
Mm.
But as you know, and I know, we treat stage 4 colon cancer until progression most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we switch to the next line of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So really the treatment duration is highly correlated to the time of progression.
Correct.
So it's not because they can stay on treatment longer, so they do better. It's because they do better, so they stay on treatment longer.
Yes. Yes.
And then this is the danger of data science, that using the data they have without understanding the background of that, how is that data coming from, and what does the data mean? They just, sometimes they tend to go fishing and then find something that's really, it's not real. And I think that's truly the danger of blindly use machine learning. And I'm not saying it's not useful, please understand.
Yeah.
It's just, I think more thought need to be put into it for it to be really powerful, to be a powerful tool for our research.
Yeah, I think that really well drives home the point that, you know, our data is not in a vacuum, but it really, you have to understand the basis behind it and and not assume that every data set is without bias. So I think that's a really good reminder for us investigators, because we tend to think, okay, we have a data set, like it is real, it is objective. But the way you collect it and how you think about it can actually be highly flawed as well.
To the second part of your question about rare cancer, I think it is a true challenge for conducting clinical trial, just because we have so few patients that we can have that enough enrollment to satisfy the statistical need to have that many patients to have properly powered study. And that definitely brings a challenge. And I don't know whether statistically we can address it somewhere, or maybe we need to invent new statistical design, but that definitely poses a challenge to conducting clinical trial nowadays. And perhaps we need better infrastructure for clinical trial, meaning maybe rather than a single institution study now, we need network of clinical trial so we can all activate the same study and really pull patients together to achieve something.
From the investigator side, we really have challenges in terms of, as you said, you know, patient accrual, in terms of budgets for these rare cancer trials. I've seen in the last few years really a lot of the success behind the research consortia. So you know, networks like ACRU and others, not only is it fun for the investigators and the teams to get together from different institutions, but I think it really the way that we're going to get these studies done in the future as we have smaller and smaller subsets of patients. But hopefully it's also more applicable to each individual patient once you get the information about what type of tumor this is, instead of just throwing everyone into the colon cancer basket saying, oh, this is HER2 amplified or BRAF mutant, and hopefully we can get better data for patients and improve their care.
Yeah, I do think precision medicine can become a reality, that we can provide the most tailored treatment option for patients. We're not there yet, but I think we're definitely on the right track.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Very encouraging. Well, I think, Pangxu, I think that's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for joining us again on this second podcast and for this great interview and all of your insights. You may hear from investigators who listen to this podcast for your expertise and you may be getting a lot more projects. So I know you're already busy with the work that you have, but thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us and kind of giving us a window into the field of biostatistics, particularly as it pertains to oncology. So thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to our listeners for joining us today as well.
Thank you.